happy to hear that. And it's quite fortuitous, I guess, especially to be able to interview you considering how much news there is right now with the shuttle, huh?
Yeah, it's capturing its portion of it. I haven't heard anything today that's different, but I have been busy and I haven't followed the news today, so I don't know any latest developments here.
Yeah, well, they claim that right now it's looking like they're going to have to do some repairs to the shuttle because of the same type of issue, you know, with the piece flying off of it. That it's very similar to what happened with Columbia. So
I wasn't aware of that. I knew that there had been a little some dings or some impact, but I haven't heard any evaluation of it yet.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate for sure, and at least now they know what the implications can be, though. So,
yep.
All right, Mike, are we ready to go? Okay, well, we are now recording, so I'll give you an introduction here, and then we'll start the interview. Okay, Dr. Mitchell?
That's fine.
Okay, great. You know, most nights we stare up into the sky and see that glowing white orb looming silently above. It's a truly striking sight that we tend to take for granted. The moon is 250,000 miles away and smaller than the United States at 2,000 miles across. There are 6 billion people on Earth and only 12 humans have actually walked on the moon. It's difficult to imagine being up there with the entire planet Earth just a blue sphere in the background, and that's why in part I'm so thrilled to speak with a man who has indeed walked on the moon, but he's also done so much more. Dr. Edgar Mitchell is a living legend, and by simply hearing this interview tonight, you are touching an important slice of history. Dr. Mitchell was the 6th man to set foot on the lunar surface via Apollo 14 in 1971, NASA's 3rd manned landing. But that was just the beginning. He had a mystical experience on the mission that changed his life and led him to form the Institute of Noetic Sciences, an organization devoted to exploring the mysterious. Well, this man obviously knows more than anyone about the reality of space travel, and he has found credible evidence for the existence of life outside our planet. I've been looking forward to this for a long time, and it is an unequivocal honor to say, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Josh. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I know how busy you are, and I want to thank you right up front for taking the time to be my guest tonight. Okay, Dr. Mitchell, let's start with the basics. Please tell us where you're from, where you are, and your description of what you do.
Well, at the moment, and for the last 20, almost 30 years, I have lived in Florida, sent to South Florida, and have been involved in research and through my institute and other avenues, my Institute of Noetic Sciences, into the nature of consciousness, and as a cosmologist and quantum physicist, trying to answer the question, how did all this start?
And that's a big question. You know, growing up, what experiences made you want to become an astronaut?
Well, I didn't have ideas of becoming an astronaut in my early days. It was too soon for that. But it was I was born in 1930, so I went through World War II as a youngster. But I graduated from college at the time of the Korean War and was going to be drafted, so I enlisted in the Navy. I was already a pilot, so I became a naval aviator. And was doing my tours of duty in the Pacific in the 1950s and became a test pilot at that point. And in October 1957, Sputnik put up. And I realized humans would be right behind robot spacecraft. And I chose at that point to see if I could change my career. I had no real plans for a Navy career. I was planning a career in business, but the war intervened, and here I was a naval officer in the Korean War. And suddenly the idea of going into space following robot spacecraft loomed on the horizon, and I shaped my career path at that point by getting a PhD, getting extra flight time and jet experience and test pilot experience, and was selected into the Apollo program in 1966.
Wow, what an honor. I mean, I can't even imagine the competition there must be for a program like that. Now, how long did the trip to the moon take, and was it comfortable?
Well, it was comfort, I guess, is a relative thing. We worked pretty hard. We had a lot to do. And, yes, going to the moon was an interesting experience. We were the third mission to the moon after following Apollo 13. The third mission to the moon, we began the scientific exploration of the moon. The first two missions, Apollo 11 and 12, were designed just to make sure we could do it and do it where we land where we wanted to land. And our mission was to build upon that and start to do exploration of the geology of the moon and set up scientific stations and bring back samples, take pictures, and be explorers. And we did that very well. My partner was on the surface, was Captain Alan Shepard, finally Admiral Alan Shepard. And our partner orbiting in the command module was Colonel Stuart Roosa. Unfortunately, both now deceased. And so here I am. I'm the last one of that particular crew.
Well, I think it's safe to say that no one listening to this program will ever walk on the moon, but you've been there. What can you tell us to help us understand what it's like to be there?
Well, I think the first observation is that those of us who went were highly motivated explorers, and for an explorer to go where humans have never been before, to set foot on an alien planet, be the first cadre of humans to set foot on an alien planet, to be able to look around, to explore. And fortunately, our studies, our simulations, our expectations were quite good. The geologists and the scientists that helped prepare us to go to the moon were very knowledgeable. Their work was good. And so we didn't find any major surprises as far as the lunar surface is concerned. And but we did start to bring back data that would confirm or allow scientists to develop better theories of the relationship of Earth to Moon, its origins, and how all this came to be.
Well, was it at all scary or eerie to see the Earth in the background like that?
No, of course. It's quite a sight, of course, to see Earth from space, particularly from the surface of the moon, and to see this magnificent little planet. At the time we were on the moon, however, we were too busy. We were programmed to about 120% of human capacity, just in case something broke and we had to abandon it. We didn't want to be left with nothing to do. So when nothing broke, we had to work to 120% of human capacity. And that meant following the checklist. We were always running behind. And it meant work, work, work. And we had a few seconds. We'd steal a few seconds every now and then to gawk at the Earth and look at the horizon and look at the panorama and the landscape and say, wow. But then back to work. And the real moments of reflection came after leaving the lunar surface, and we had 3 days on the way home, relatively light work in a well-functioning spacecraft. And for me, that was a very high point, being able to look out of the spacecraft, of the cabin windows. And since we were rotating, kind of like on a barbecue spit, to keep thermal balance on the spacecraft. That meant that every couple of minutes, the whole panorama of Earth, Moon, Sun, stars, heavens, galaxies, would pass through the cabin window. And that was wow.
Oh, I bet.
And our listeners have to realize that in space, without the intervening atmosphere, the heavens, the stars, and the galaxies, and the galactic clusters, and everything is about 10 times brighter, an order of magnitude brighter, and more numerous than you can see from Earth. So it's a truly awesome, really awesome experience. And that was what led to, very shortly, as I watched this, Since, of course, my earlier training, as I mentioned, I got a doctorate from MIT, and I'd studied astronomy and all of the things appropriate to trying to go into space. And I realized that the molecules of my body and the molecules of the spacecraft and the molecules in the body of my partners have been prototyped in some ancient generation of stars. That's the way we know how matter is formed. And instead of an intellectual experience, it became a very personal knowing. Those were my molecules. Mm-hmm. A very visceral experience. And accompanied by an ecstasy, a wow, mountaintop, a peak experience, a lot of words for it. Mm-hmm. And this continued for when I wasn't consumed with chores in the spacecraft. And this continued all the way home. And it was such a powerful experience with this ecstatic experience and this insight. I call it an epiphany, if you will, that when I came back, I started doing some research to see if I could understand if there was anything in the literature that told me about this type of peak experience, this insight. And in the science literature, there was nothing. And I had to start digging through mystical literature. And finally found it, after a few months' research, finally found it in the ancient literature of the Sanskrit of India, and found that the experience that I had had in space had a name, and it was called samadhi, or salvakalpa samadhi, to be particular, which means that you see things in all their separateness, but you experience them viscerally as a oneness, as a whole, as a unity. And it's accompanied by an ecstasy, a wow. And so I was satisfied. I had a name for what was happening. And I continued to research and into different cultures and found that virtually in the lore, in the mystical traditions, in the verbal traditions, or whether it be the mystics of all cultures, somewhere in the dim, dark past, had reported this type of experience. They had different names for it and maybe a little different description, but if it was tantamount to exactly the same experience. And that turned out to be the common experience or transcendent experience common to every culture. And whether that culture called them shamans, witch doctors, medicine men, kahuna, or whatever they called them, they were the ones who had reported, recorded, and talked about these experiences. And the interesting thing is that the experience was the same, and much of the description is the same, but then when the people, the culture, tries to express it and describe it, apart from the mystics who have had it, those who haven't had the experience try to utilize it. Let's call that the exoteric. The experience itself we might call the esoteric, transcendent experience, but the expression of it is called the exoteric. And in all the cultures, the exoteric seems to be different, although it's based on the same experience. And that exoteric experience is the basis of our religions. And all of our cultural religions seem to be markedly different. And we fight over whose God's the best God and whose interpretation's the best interpretation. But my research says they're all based in the same essence of deep understanding. And that's the story.
Well, did the other astronauts have similar experiences?
As a matter of fact, they did. And it precisely illustrated what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Most of the people like myself who were lunar module pilots and had their most of their work completed after we left the lunar surface had a similar type experience. And by talking to them, I realized we had an identical experience. But because of our different background and belief systems and understandings of nature and religious traditions, we did just what I said. We all expressed it in different words, but it was the same experience.
Well, now, this was such an overwhelming, powerful experience for all of you. How do you respond to these people who suggest that men have never gone to the moon?
Well, I don't particularly worry about them. I had one of them in my house, and as soon as he revealed what he was about, I threw him out, banished him from my house. But my response basically is, do you really think the Soviets would have let us get away with making all of this? This was a race for superiority in space, the United States against the Soviet Union. And do you really think they would have let us make it? Of course not. They'd blown the whistle immediately. So the best answer is, if this was a political, started out as a political mission, it was political in nature and for control of space, and the Soviets would not have let us do what is being accused of, we're accused of. That's a simple answer.
Sure.
And of course, there's a good website, badastronomy.com, that goes through each and every one of the so-called hoax or arguments and puts a lie to them. There's no validity in them whatsoever.
Well, you know, the brute force of rocketry seems crude compared with some of the electromagnetic technologies we understand. Do you think NASA has more advanced craft traveling into space that is currently classified?
Well, I can't say that NASA does. I am pretty well convinced that there are more exotic craft than where the public's aware of. Now, how many of those in these days are really under control of Earth entities, I can't say for sure. But there are techniques of space travel that are not in our public domain at the moment.
So what evidence have you seen for life in the universe apart from what is found on Earth?
Well, I don't think that I have personally ever been convinced since going into space that we're alone in the universe. The universe is too magnificent, too huge, too large, and the notion that we're alone in the universe is a very primitive idea of primitive peoples. But beyond that, the question of we're only now scientifically coming to identify planets and star systems within our galaxy and some of them not too far away that might possibly be bearers of life like on Earth. However, I have also, although I have no personal experience with this, I have been briefed and I have been among people who are in the know, and I know we have been visited and have continued to be visited for some time, and the UFO phenomenon, as we so-called UFO phenomenon, is a valid real phenomenon, and we have been visited. And I don't know all the details. I know a few, but I do not know enough details. I don't consider myself an expert at all in that area, except to say that I know it's all real.
So why do you think the government or whoever has access is keeping all this secret and keeping it away from the public?
Well, there's a long history with that, and it goes back to World War II, really. Excuse me, I've got a little cut in my throat. It goes back to World War II, when right after World War II, the Army Air Corps was changed into the Air Force, and the OSS, Division of Government Office of Special Services, was disbanded and became the CIA, and a whole host of political and military metamorphosis was taking place. At that point in time, not anybody really knew who was on first. That is the time of the so-called 1947 Roswell incident. And as a result of that, and it was directly President President Truman who set up a commission to investigate that. And it was set in, I don't remember, it's the National Security Act, I think, of 1947. That is the prevailing law that was passed to bring this under classification, under very limited control at that point. And it's been under that very limited secret control ever since. And I'm afraid, I personally think it's a very incestuous organization that has grown self-perpetuating and excluding most anybody that tries to know about it, including presidents and any other high-level officials. So I don't quite know where this is going, except I'm hoping it's going to be broken open here in the not-too-distant future and the public more fully informed as to what's really going on.
Well, now, when we think of extraterrestrials, we think of, you know, the Greys or these different types of models of an alien. Are those accurate so far as you understand? Are they humanoid to that degree?
As far as I know, the so-called Greys is a fairly accurate description of at least one of the groups. How many of the groups there really are, I am not qualified to speak. I have been told, or with a certain amount of authority, that there's more than one, perhaps up to four or so. But I have I don't have the knowledge to properly speak to that.
Well, you know, some people suggest that these creatures are actually from Earth, that they don't come from outer space, but you know differently from what you've understood. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And so do you think that they themselves are cooperating with our government or our government so that they can benefit in some way? Or, I mean, what do they want from civilization so far as you've understood?
I cannot answer that with any great specificity.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly I see no hostile intent here that I'm aware of. There may be, if there's more than one group, there may be some of them with hostile intent. But were there hostile intent, they certainly have capabilities far exceeding ours. So if that was the case, we wouldn't really have much recourse. But I don't think that's the case. And we haven't seen anything but observation and cooperation as far as I know.
How do you feel about the accuracy of the abduction phenomenon?
Well, I do not consider myself expert in that, but Professor John Mack of Harvard, whom I knew quite well, now deceased as of last October, I considered one of the leading thinkers and investigators in that area, and he was convinced that many of the people he worked with had valid type experiences, that they were not simply hallucinations or other forms of mental aberration, but were recollections of true experience. Now, there are other investigators who would agree with that, and I would tend to go along with Dr. Mack's assessment that he had truly interviewed valid experiencers.
Well, you know, you're a man of such pristine credentials that you're surely being monitored by the government. How do government agencies and other astronauts feel about your willingness to be honest and open regarding these secret extraterrestrial issues?
Well, in many ways, I guess I'm kind of a lone ranger here. But there are quite a number of very, very good investigators who have spent many years looking at these phenomena. I'm certainly not alone in saying this, and I have relied upon, in many ways, the investigations and the pronouncements of people certainly more involved in all this than I have been.
And so we hear all these stories about men in black or, you know, curious agents poking around scenes and people that have some connection to UFOs. Have you encountered that sort of thing?
No, I have not personally. definitely been involved with that.
So now, your experiences span such a wide range that most people can't even relate. Aside from your experience coming back from the moon, what is the weirdest thing you've experienced in your life?
Well, that's an original question. Something different. I guess that it all has to do with the several phenomena I have worked with as a result of that space experience, in which I have worked with some rather interesting people, like Uri Geller, for example, and healers who, and I have been the object of healing activity here in recent years, and have observed and worked with some very fine healers over the years that, and of course I have spent a lot of time trying to understand these phenomena. And my Institute of Noetic Sciences was put together particularly for the purpose of trying to bring science to bear upon these quote mystical experiences. And as I pointed out earlier in our conversation here, they are rooted in the same transcendent experience that's reported in every culture. And that being the case, it should be something that science can take a look at. And my colleagues and I, for the last 30 years, in growing numbers, have come to try to understand this phenomenon of consciousness and its many manifestations, not only as manifest in we normal humans, but in the extraordinary capabilities of healers, shamans, mystics, people like Uri Geller and others that I have worked with, who exhibit a very powerful capability, and let's call it intentionality. In other words, we've come to understand intentionality counts for something. Mm-hmm. It does affect the world we live in. Now, we don't create our reality, but we sure as the world participate and interact with it and change it by our choices. Mm-hmm. So I have been studying these type of phenomena for 30-some years now.
Wow. And so have you personally witnessed telekinetic effects?
Oh, yes, many times.
Well, that's just mind-boggling. So, ultimately, where do you think we should focus in order to make the next big breakthrough in understanding? Where do we have the highest chances?
Well, in my personal opinion on this, and my own in my own experience, that many of the answers that we're looking for will come from the area of quantum physics, that much of these phenomena are quantum phenomena. And I need to explain that just a little bit. The very basic phenomenon and attributes that are involved are called entanglement, coherence, non-locality, and resonance. And these are quantum phenomena of quantum information and long believed for most of the 20th century to be the reserve and the preserve of quantum physicists who were only looking at the subatomic matter. And as it turns out, it really, and it's been believed for all that time, that such phenomena really didn't have much to do with our scale size of things, the size of macro-scale matter, but really only pertain to subatomic matter. Mm-hmm. And that's just dead wrong. It's not true. And we have started in the last few years to see exactly how many of the attributes of our bio nature and our mental nature and our consciousness nature, or even our spiritual nature, are quantum effects. And to me, that may not be the final answer, but it's certainly an area of investigation that has to be explored far more thoroughly before we can even begin to get
know, I recently interviewed Dr. Sally Ryan Feather, who is the daughter of J.B. Ryan.
Oh, I know her quite well.
Okay, and her co-author, Michael Schmicker, and they were saying there is just overwhelming evidence in the laboratory for the existence of ESP, yet the general public still doesn't understand and appreciate that. And what do you think is this barrier that we have between the proof that has already been established in the laboratory and affecting the general mindset of the public?
Well, the real problem has always been lack of a mechanism that confirms how this could happen. And it certainly cannot be explained in classical physics, but it can be explained in quantum physics, and we now understand the information mechanism by which it works, and it's called quantum holography. It's the fact that at the fundamental quantum level of matter, that matter is emitting and reabsorbing photons of energy continuously. And colleagues of ours in Europe, a particular gentleman, professor by the name of Professor Walter Schempp at the University of Siegen in Germany almost 10 years ago, while working with MRI machines and trying to improve the specificity of MRI machines, discovered the quantum hologram. And what that really means is that he was studying the emissions from matter, particularly things he was trying to do, get MRI pictures of, and started using group phenomenon in his mathematics, group analysis in his mathematics, instead of just the mathematics of particles and waves and so forth. Let me explain a little bit what that means. If you take a look at your fingertip, if you look at one of the swirls or the ridges on your finger, it doesn't tell you much about yourself. But if you look at these swirls on all 10 fingers put together, that's called your fingerprint, and it uniquely identifies you. What Dr. Schempp discovered is if you studied the group emissions from any bit of matter, it carried the images and the information, unique information about that matter. And if you assiduously apply that to the concept of many of the concepts of psychic information, it's been well demonstrated for many years now, 25 or 30 years, that psychic information is non-local, or quantum information. Non-local information is a quantum term, and that's been known for some time. So suddenly we have an information mechanism in nature called quantum holography that very aptly and completely explains all of these types of non-local, quote, psychic information. And for illustration, we call our intuitive faculties our sixth sense. Well, it should be called our first sense, because it came along long before our five other senses and is involved in the organization of matter in all planetary environments. It's a very fundamental information characteristic that's just now becoming recognized in science. And what Dr. Schempp's discovery helped us realize is that information at this level is as important as energy itself, and that we live in a universe that uses and utilizes its information, which makes it a very intelligent universe that we live in. And I have a saying that's come out of my work and all of this type of work that describes the universe as a self-organizing, intelligent, learning, creating, trial and error, participatory, interactive, non-locally interconnected, evolutionary system. And that's the type of universe we live in.
Well, very well stated and very insightful as well. And I wonder, do you think that people are evolving to become more or less psychic as time goes on?
No. Understanding of this convinced that the transcendent experience, which I've previously said to you, is has been around for centuries and millennia in limited amount, but that we're evolving, that the species is evolving toward more and more of the transcendent experience. In other words, learning the transcendent experience really means getting out of ego, getting beyond the ego state of perception. And I think that is an evolutionary path. I wish I had more evidence to support that.
Well, now, when it comes to all of the different disciplines of science that you've studied, what do you think are the chances that we can indeed extract free energy from the vacuum?
Well, there's an enormous amount of work going on in that area right now. And certainly all quantum physicists have come to accept that in... Or either accepting or about to accept or will accept in the due course that in each cubic centimeter of space there's enough residual energy to create the entire universe. And we have a lot to do in order to reliably learn how to extract that. We have so far, it's been very limited. We have, to my knowledge, no real so-called over-unity devices of any significance. In other words, it can produce more energy than it requires to operate them. But there are many who have gotten close to that, and I think it's a very important area for the future, frankly.
And, of course, that may give us some insight into how some of these UFOs function, I suppose.
Of course, absolutely.
And, you know, for people who want to go out and investigate UFOs, who want to see if that light in the sky might be something extraordinary, are there any tools or techniques that you would recommend to a person who wants to have first-hand research experience?
Well, there's a lot in the literature. I would recommend that those who are really interested, there are some very good books and some very fine research people. There's also some stuff that's pretty fringy. And there's, because of the cover-up phenomenon, there's about as much disinformation out there is good information. So it takes a lot of work and discrimination to really sort the wheat from the chaff and start to understand a little bit of what's really going on. Some of the work that Dr. Wood and his son Ryan, blocking on his first name, have done with regard to forensic study of the early documents is quite impressive. And I would recommend serious research people dig into the literature, and they'll be able to sort out fairly quickly what is some pretty good stuff.
You know, a lot of people in the general public have this idea that a guy like yourself would be assassinated for talking about all these things that are secret. Do you think if the government did that it would only confirm what you're saying?
Of course.
You know, and
that's the reason. That's the reason. Pretty safe about it.
Yeah. And yet I'm sure.
But also, let's talk about government a little bit.
Okay.
You see, in today's government and compartmentalization of black programs and compartmentalization in government, most people in government, 99% of people in government, don't know anything more about any of this than you do,
mm-hmm.
or I do. Like many mostly know less. So we have to be careful when we use the word government. There are a few people in very key positions that know what's going on, and nobody else knows anything at all.
Yeah, and it's easy for us to just slap that big label government onto everything.
Absolutely.
That we, yeah.
Absolutely. And it's simply not correct.
Right. And, of course, things are so compartmentalized. Anybody who knows something, I'm sure, only knows one little facet. One
Absolutely.
Of the
oh, yes, yes. There are very, very few that really have a broad grasp of all of this.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel about, say, the face on Mars, for example? Is that just the brain making sense of a random form or something?
Well, it's a little more insidious than that. I know the people involved with that pretty well, and I have no real, I don't have much empathy or agreement with all of that.
Yeah. So it's sort of like maybe seeing the man in the moon, perhaps. So.
Yeah, or rabbits in clouds and so forth.
Sure. Do you think that there are any structures on the moon that we don't know about?
Well, it's entirely possible, but I know of none. We pretty well photographed most of the moon. I know of none that have been validated, that have any validation at all.
So, you know, you'd mentioned the Roswell incident. Do you think that was a major turning point when it comes to our connection, our contact?
It's kind of the beginning. The Roswell incident is kind of the beginning of the modern era in this. I am convinced that now that we have been visited for a long, long time. There are very compelling paintings going back to some of Michelangelo's work of UFOs in the sky and some of his paintings. At least they certainly look like that. And I'm pretty sure they haven't been added in recent years. So there is some evidence now that we have, that I will accept it, now that we have been, we see the modern evidence and have, some of us at least who have been investigating this, are very confident that we have been visited, then that gives some credence to the fact that when we go back to these ancient texts and ancient pictures and see things like what Michelangelo painted, we can say, hey, they were here then too.
Yeah, some of those are absolutely compelling. Well, you know, for more than 30 years, I'm sure everybody's been asking you, what's it like to be on the moon? What's it like to be on the moon? But really, what do you think would surprise people most about the experience of traveling there, walking on the moon, the whole situation? What do people not expect that you could pass along that would be perhaps insightful?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think we have talked about it. We've explored it and expressed it quite openly, most of us. And so it's just a matter of getting it out into the schools, getting it in. There's a lot of information. Our astronaut scholarship fund, which the Mercury 7 astronauts originated, and those of us who came a bit later have followed on with and are part of, we're doing our best to help educate young people, get them more involved in being excited about space and exploration. And I have to admit, it gives me pause when I stop to think that over the half the people alive today weren't born when I went to the moon.
Yeah.
And that I have to come up short when I think about that. And so we are ancient history as opposed to anything in the experience of most of the people alive. So we have a big education problem on our hands.
Did you know a NASA engineer named Charles Yost?
That name rings a bell, but I can't quite pull it together right now.
He just passed away last March, and I knew him for about...
Okay, I think I heard that, but I still can't pull in where I knew him.
Yeah, he actually was one of the inventors of Tempur-Pedic foam there and ended up in the NASA Hall of Fame for that work and went on to create a company called Dynamic Systems and an electric spacecraft journal here in Western North Carolina, and did a lot of research regarding new types of designs for spacecraft. Do you have any visions as far as what the next type of craft will be after the shuttles are out of commission?
Well, yes. Let me try to put it in context. I have no doubt that we will go back to the moon. I have no doubt that we will go on to Mars. I have no doubt that we will explore deeply into our solar system with manned craft in due course. How soon that will be, I don't know. But I will put it in this context. When we go to Mars and look back at Earth and see this tiny little speck that represents Earth, it would sound a bit foolish to say I came from the United States or France or Germany or Russia or Israel or Britain or wherever. No, we came from Earth. And we're not ready to do that yet.
Yeah.
And I don't know quite when we will be ready to do that. But that is our destiny. I mean, we can't continue to be a divided, warlike civilization. Sooner or later, we have to come to our senses and realize we have to cooperate for our betterment and our good, better good. But we're not there yet. Now, when we do that, we will have to have spacecraft and systems quite different than we have now. But I have written papers and been published in the Journal of Physics and other places that said we would likely do that before this end of this century that we're in, provided we don't destroy ourselves in the process by being stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a finite risk that we might destroy ourselves. But I happen to hope and I believe that we will come to our senses, manage these crises that we're in, and get on with it, get on with the business of creating a civilization that we can somewhat be proud of.
Well, those are certainly some profound thoughts that hopefully everyone will reflect on, the implications there being very wide. And, you know, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, we are out of time. I could talk to you all night long, so it's easy to see why you have such a demanding schedule. But thank you for all you've done and continue to do to press forward our understanding of the universe. And I especially appreciate you taking the time to honor us with your insight and be my guest tonight.
Okay, thank you, Josh. It's good to talk to you.
Absolutely. Well, that was Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, and altogether there have been only 12. You can visit his website at edmitchellapollo14.com. That, again, is www.edmitchellapollo14.com. All right, Dr. Mitchell, I should have asked you this earlier, but I saw that we were running out of time. Is there anything else that you would like for me to mention, aside from your website, for listeners?
Well, you might mention the Noetic website also.
Okay, and what's that?
Noetic.org.
Okay, Noetic.org. We will make sure we'll have those linked up on our website, and we'll do everything to get the word out about those as well. You know, you're a fascinating man, and, you know, it's so exciting to have you here as a guest on the program. And, you know, if there's ever any way that I can be helpful, you know, getting the word out or promoting anything that you have, it'd be my pleasure to do so.
Thank you very much, Josh. It's a pleasure working with you.
Yes, absolutely. And, I'm very happy to hear that you're back in good health, sir.
I'm certainly back in good health. Hopefully I'll be strong enough to resume all my schedule here in the next few weeks.
All right.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.